this new category of operations, which is launching a strike against sovereign Arab countries by Israel, other than Lebanon, of course, has caused many Arab leaders to think twice about whether they can afford to remain passive.
The way to achieve security is through building a world based on love and justice and kindness.
I have a proposal which seeks to make nonviolence an organizing principle in our society, the creation of a Department of Peace.
An independent report released by the Pentagon indicates that exposure to radioactive material used in the Gulf War is unlikely to have caused the health complaints from veterans whose illnesses remain unexplained 8 years after the war. Then you explain why veterans are puking up orange vomit.
This is a special edition of Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, October 7th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Insurgents killed three U.S. soldiers with roadside bombs, the military reported today, and former Iraqi intelligence officers demanding jobs hurled stones and charged American forces guarding occupation headquarters in the capital. Large sections of Baghdad were in turmoil. There was an explosion inside the foreign ministry compound about a half mile from the confrontation outside the U.S.-led occupation headquarters. Across the city, U.S. soldiers were met with a demonstration by Shiite Muslims after closing a mosque and allegedly arresting the imam. Late in the afternoon, U.S. troops fired concussion grenades and shots in the air to disperse the crowd, which grew by the hour. By nightfall, an estimated 200 American troops backed by helicopters and at least six MiA-2 tanks had sealed off the area, and more Americans and Iraqi protesters converged on the scene. As the midnight curfew approached, however, the standoff eased with the Americans pulling back most of their forces. Shortly afterwards, the protesters began leaving the area as well. L. Paul Bremer, the U.S. Administrator for Iraq, said the capital is in trouble. President Bush questioned today whether investigators would be able to determine who leaked the identity of an undercover CIA officer, but said he still hoped they would. Officials said materials gathered by White House staff members under orders from the Justice Department in the case would be screened before being turned over to the FBI. White House staff members had been given a Tuesday deadline for turning in any relevant information, but the president's spokesman said it could take as long as 2 weeks to check those submissions for relevance to decide which should be given to criminal investigators. Spokesman Scott McClellan would not rule out the possibility that the White House would invoke executive privilege to shield sensitive documents from the Justice Department's inquiry. He said it was premature to talk about such a step. U.S. Congressman and presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich and consumer advocate Ralph Nader will be speaking at a giant rally in the nation's capital this evening. Many of the issues on the agenda are of particular interest to local constituents, such as opposition to the school voucher plan proposed by D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams. Peace Watch spoke with Kucinich today about the California recall election that is taking place. An election supervisor says this is the largest turnout they have seen in 12 years. We spoke with Kucinich about the other issues on the agenda for this evening, including, of course, his candidacy. We asked him if he felt the California recall election would have a significant impact on the presidential election of 2004.
I'm hopeful that the turnout means that people will be voting against the recall. And what we've seen since 2000 with the theft of the election in Florida, with the attempt to change the redistricting in Texas and to pack Republicans into the Texas delegation, and now with the totally unwarranted recall in California, we're seeing an attack on our democratic process itself. So hopefully the response of the voters in California will be to repudiate this effort to try to cancel the results of the 2002 election in California, and will cause the people of California to be absolutely insistent on their right to be able to choose a governor they can call their own.
Well, polls vary, but depending on which camp you refer to, but some have the actor Arnold Schwarzenegger leading the polls there. What kind of impact would it have on this presidential race if Arnold Schwarzenegger is actually the governor of California? And I know there'd have to be a couple of steps before that would actually happen.
Well, I think we have to wait and see. But beyond that, you know, people win elections for a combination of reasons, one of which is name recognition. And he certainly had an advantage of name recognition. However, I think that ultimately when people choose a president, they choose a president based on an ethics, on character, on a vision for a country. And I don't think that the outcome of the election in California is going to in any way dissuade the American people from the qualifications which they believe are necessary in a president.
One of the candidates for the presidential nomination, the Democratic presidential nomination, Senator Bob Graham, has dropped out of the race at this early stage, saying last night, quote, "I cannot be elected." What are your thoughts about that early departure on the part of Senator Graham, and do you see him as possibly a candidate for the vice presidential slot?
Well, I'm sorry he left the race, and of course he would be qualified to serve in any capacity. However, now that he has left the race, that leaves me as the only candidate who voted against the war in Iraq, and I remain the only candidate who voted against the Patriot Act. So my candidacy becomes even more contrasted with those who remain in the race.
And so, Congressman, we know that you are holding a rally in the nation's capital tonight, and many of the issues on the agenda are of particular local interest, such as securing affordable health care for the district residents and opposition to the school voucher plan proposed by the district's mayor, Anthony Williams. What are some of the other issues you're planning to discuss? In addition, I'm assuming that your candidacy will be among those issues, but what else?
Well, I'm going to be talking about the necessity of America turning away from a dedication to war, which this administration has brought, away from preemption and unilateralism, and towards working with the world community in the cause of international security. We want to make sure that our nation is safe, but the only way we can do that is working with the world community. We cannot make America safe by attacking nations which had nothing to do with 9/11 and with nations which did not attack us. Furthermore, I intend to talk about the importance of directing our attention towards creating peace in our communities. And as a former mayor, I understand how important it is that we look at issues of violence in our own society, at domestic violence, spousal abuse, child abuse, at violence between police and community groups, violence of a racial nature, or violence against gays. We have a great deal of work to do in our society, and I have a proposal which seeks to make nonviolence an organizing principle in our society, the creation of a Department of Peace.
What are the three top issues that you're hearing the people in the grassroots communities that you're, I would believe, are visiting or talking to as you tour the country? What are the main issues they're concerned about?
Three issues. First of all, health care. Every American is aware that this health care for profit system is corrupt, and it's time to have a system which cares about people, not about profit. So that's why I'm for universal single-payer Medicare for all. Second, getting out of Iraq. All Americans want to get out of Iraq. All Americans understand this is a disaster. We want to get our troops home. It's time to get the UN in and the U.S. out of Iraq. And third, trade. You know, we have a $435 billion trade deficit that keeps widening because America created trade structures in NAFTA and the WTO, which makes it impossible for us to be able to maintain our economic security in this country. I've said, as president, I'll cancel NAFTA and the WTO and return to bilateral trade that's conditioned on workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles.
And so what about the issues of housing and education and discrimination and police brutality? You're saying that those are not uppermost on the minds of the electorate?
Well, they are on the minds of the electorate, and they're issues that I speak to as a former mayor and as someone who's concerned about housing and wants to make sure that people have decent housing. You know, I'm prepared to move forward with an agenda that includes construction of new housing, making housing more affordable, making housing available for families, making housing available for people who are low income. That's all part of what I'm intending to do as the next president
Representative Kucinich, this weekend Israel attacked a target in Syria, claiming that it was retaliating for a suicide bombing that killed 19 Israelis a day earlier. Although the group Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility for this suicide bombing, it also asserted that it had no training camps, no terrorist training camps in Syria, and that the site that was actually targeted had been abandoned for 7 years. And while President Bush criticized Israel for taking an action that may escalate tensions in the region where the political climate is already quite tense, his condemnation of the attack was not widespread or as harsh as some might have wanted it to be. And the U.S. has also alleged on several occasions in the past that Syria has aided and harbored terrorist groups, but Syria asserts it was actually helpful to the U.S. in the months leading up to the war. What is your perspective on how Syria seems to now be being targeted by Israel and perhaps the U.S. as well?
It is really important that we work within the United Nations, and the United States government forfeited its moral authority to speak out against unilateralism when we unilaterally and preemptively attacked Iraq. We need to insist on the United Nations being involved in all difficulties and all claims of conflict between nations.
Democratic Congressman and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich will speak at a rally here in the nation's capital this evening with consumer advocate and former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said today that his country was ready to attack its enemies anywhere following its air raid on a target northwest of Damascus, Syria, on Sunday. That attack was allegedly in retaliation for a suicide bombing launched the day before by the group Islamic Jihad. Though Islamic Jihad took responsibility for the bombing, it denied having training bases in Syria anymore, and it said that the photos Israel circulated of the bases were several years old. At the United Nations yesterday, Israel faced worldwide condemnation for its actions, and President Bush said that while Israel had a right to defend itself, it should avoid actions that would likely escalate tensions in the region. But speaking at a memorial service today marking the anniversary of the 1976 Middle East War, Prime Minister Sharon seemed bolstered by American support for Israel's right to self-defense, and he said that Israel will not be deterred from defending its citizens and will hit its enemies any place and in any way. For reaction to the events, Reem Khadhuda of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C., spoke with Bassam Haddad, adjunct professor of government at Georgetown University and editor of the Arab Studies Journal.
The attack on these so-called bases in Syria by Israel, deflecting the kind of pressure and tension and the problems that Israel is facing internally, and using efforts vis-a-vis Syria to perhaps expand the operations that Israel is engaged in, and ride the wave that has been created in the U.S. regarding support for the Syria Accountability Act, and use that as the proper timing to launch such an attack. Use also the analogy with Afghanistan, whereby Israel justified its totally indefensible violation of international law. This is a reflection of the desperation of Israel's government amid falling ratings and amidst the problems that Israel cannot control locally. I mean, for the past 20-some years, Israel has made claims, all kinds of military equipment, arsenals existing in either Syria or Syria's sphere, the Bekaa Valley and elsewhere. I really do not think that a lot of these pretexts are what is really going on. In fact, I think that this is a sign of weakness for Israel, and the only issue that I foresee is that Syria is not prepared to answer in kind, because it knows that Israel would simply welcome this kind of response so that it can launch broader attacks. This puts Syria in a very tough position, because it cannot be silent and at the same time it cannot respond in kind. A known fact that the offices that are occupied in Damascus by groups that are Palestinian or that belong to Palestinian resistance are ineffectual. They're primarily press offices that have very little influence on what goes on inside Palestine. It is not like Palestinians in Palestine are sitting and waiting until people who work in press offices across the border make decisions for them or to give them justifications or motivations to do anything. This is the brutality of the occupation engenders these reactions by Palestinians. The U.S.'s comment on the situation is preposterous. The U.S. was basically asking Israel not to escalate the situation after it has already invaded Syria's sovereignty, struck at areas inside Syria using very heavy firepower and violated a number of conjunctions in international law. And I think that one of the reasons Israel has been able to get away with much of what it has been doing is because the U.S. is continuously taking on operations in the Middle East using the war against terror as a justification. The other point that really is significant here is that there is ample support in Congress for the Syria Accountability Act, and for the first time in several months, maybe more than a year or two also, the White House did not strike down this proposal. So it's a particular moment that Israel seized, and it remains to be seen whether it will escalate or whether it's simply a strategy to create a new category of operations by Israel that may actually continue to take place. In other words, redrawing or refashioning the rules of interaction of the game in the Middle East. A bill introduced by very right-wing Lebanese organizations in the United States that wants to hold Syria responsible for a number of things, including the existence of its military in Lebanon. The larger aim of the bill is to make arguments that justify strikes against Syria. The Syria Accountability Act is the pretext, the legal, quote-unquote, pretext for launching a strike against Syria. And events in the region, especially with Iraq not going the way the U.S. had wanted it to go, the U.S. government has wanted it to go, I think there is even more chance at trying to expand beyond Iraq, either to cover up problems in Iraq or to not show signs of weakness. And I think that's a very dubious and problematic strategy. There is a difference in tone, not because Arab leaders are ready to do something individually or ready or capable of working in concert. This new category of operations, which is launching a strike against sovereign Arab country by Israel, other than Lebanon, of course, has caused many Arab leaders to think twice about whether they can afford to remain passive. My guess is there must be some sort of a department in the United States government that is in charge of continuously diminishing its credibility in the region, because for the past couple of decades, it's simply creating more and more reasons for its credibility to diminish in the eyes of the Arab people, if not the leadership. Beginning with the various issues in the past two or three decades that have to do with the support of Israel, all the way to the sanctions on Iraq, then the war in Iraq and its enforcing of resolutions that have to do with virtually all countries in the region and vetoing resolutions that condemn Israel. This kind of resume has basically caused the U.S. to lose almost all credibility for the war against Iraq and its current occupation.
Bassam Haddad, adjunct professor of government in Georgetown University and editor of the Arab Studies Journal. He spoke with Reem Khadhuda of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. As we've been announcing at the end of our show, this is our last week on the air here at Peace Watch. Our staff will take a break for the next several weeks to enter planning and production for a new program to be launched November 3rd on most Pacifica stations and affiliates. In the meantime, we're bringing you a series of our favorite and most memorable speeches and interviews from our archives that we deem to have relevance to events in the news today. Among them is this conversation we had last October with Rabbi Michael Lerner, the editor of Tikkun magazine. We featured him as part of our series of religious leaders who offered spiritual responses to the war in Iraq.
Well, I think it's a terrible error and an immoral path. The fundamental problem facing humanity today is how to overcome the selfishness and materialism and me-firstism that that shapes contemporary consciousness, and how to develop a consciousness, an alternative consciousness of us as part of a world in which we are all interrelated and interdependent. And that new consciousness is the critical need for the 21st century. Unless that is sustained, there's no way that we're going to be able to solve the impact of 150 years of destruction of the ecological systems of this planet. And the only way we can do that is to overcome our individualism, our selfishness, our me-firstism, or in the case of nation-states, our we-firstism, and come to work together in a collective and cooperative way. Anything that contributes to the individualism, the selfishness, the we-firstism or me-firstism, the separation of one group against another, actually is detrimental to the well-being of the whole human race and the future survivability of our planet. And the war in Iraq is a perfect example of this destructive path. On the simplest level, it's destructive to the ecology, and it's a murderous policy that will involve the killings of many, many, many people. But beyond the specifics of the war, what the war does is it puts forward and reinforces every tendency in the human race to think in terms of me-firstism or we-firstism, rather than of how we get together as a world and solve our problems together. This is America saying our way or no way. We're going to impose our will on others. Well, it's precisely that kind of thinking of I'm going to impose my will on everyone else that is the center of the spiritual crisis of the contemporary world, the sense that what I need is more important than what everybody else needs, that my ego is the center of the universe, is really at the core of the breakdown of the spiritual connections between human beings that has created the crisis of the contemporary world, and whose greatest manifestation is global capital in all of its distortion.
That sounds like a very progressive concept and perspective on your part. Are there tenets of that are found within the Jewish teachings?
Well, absolutely. There are within the Jewish teachings both tendencies towards understanding our interconnection with all other human beings and also counter tendencies, because when Jews heard the word of God, we heard it through the context of the framework of individuals and of a people that has both lots of love in it and lots of distortion in it, like every other people on the planet. So all of the religious and spiritual traditions have both this tendency that I'm talking about to affirm the interconnectedness, the love, transcendence of ego, recognition of the unity of all being, the oneness of all with all, and also counter tendencies that are egotistical, nationalistic, chauvinistic, reducing the other to a means, asserting that my way is the only way, my path to religion or my path to God is the only appropriate path, and everybody else is going to be damned. All of these things also exist in every religion, because, of course, every religion, every spiritual path is a product of human beings who are split in the same way. So when I talk to you about our spiritual tradition, I'm affirming one part of its strand, one of its central strands, and I'm simultaneously arguing against those strands in our religious spiritual traditions that mirror the distortions of the economic and political world that we live in.
For the millions of Jewish Americans who seek peace in the world and especially do not support going to war with Iraq, what is the spiritual role that they should play?
Well, I think that the first thing that we need to affirm is that the world that we seek, a world of peace and justice and love, can only be acquired, can only be achieved through a path that is a path of love and peace and justice. That there is no way to achieve security, either for Israel or for the United States, by domination, control, power over others, and violence. That the way to achieve security is through building a world based on love and justice and kindness. And so, and that has to start with us right now. It has to start with Israel, and it has to start with American policy, both domestically and internationally. So if when I address Israel, I talk about the need for Israel to reject the path of violence that Ariel Sharon has taken us on and to instead affirm a path of reconciliation with our neighbors, in which the core bottom line has to be that we recognize that the Palestinian people are equally valuable, equally to be cherished as every Jew, and their suffering is just as important as Jewish suffering, that we're all equally created in the image of God. And when I look at America and I say, well, how does America get security for itself? How do we fight the terrorists? Then I say the way to get security for America is for America to become known as the number one force in the world seeking to end poverty and oppression, the force that is using its resources to end all forms of homelessness and hunger and inadequate medical care and inadequate education. Just, for example, by taking that $1.5 trillion that President Bush is giving back disproportionately to the richest in the society in the form of a tax cut, take that and let that be our initial Marshall Plan for the world to try to begin to end poverty and hunger and homelessness. The United States is known as that, number one. And number two, known as the world's leading force fighting for ecological sanity and repair of the planet, rather than as it is known today, as the force, the leading force that is blocking ecological agreements in order to protect the interests of our corporations. And if number three, America were to adopt and really embody a new bottom line so that institutions and social practices in our society were judged efficient, rational, and productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money and power, but to the extent that they maximize love and caring, to the extent that they maximize ecological, ethical, and spiritual consciousness, and to the extent that they maximize people's capacities to transcend a narrow utilitarianism and to look at other human beings and at the world with a spirit of awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation. Well, if the United States were fostering that as our new bottom line here and were the force that was identified as the major force for ecological sanity and as the force that was primarily using its resources to work for the elimination of poverty, homelessness, and hunger in this on this planet, America would have achieved the kind of security in relationship to the rest of the world that it will never achieve through beating up on Iraq or through military domination.
Since you touched upon Israel and Palestine, I'm going to sneak in a political question here. It's almost impossible to have this discussion without it's sort of like the elephant in the middle of the room.
By the way, you see, we in the Jewish world have never believed that there is such a thing as a separation between spiritual and political. I mean, the whole spiritual story of the Jewish people that we read in our Torah is about the political liberation from Egypt. Mm-hmm. So these issues go very closely together. And
yes,
you can't talk about the Middle East or peace or whatever without talking about Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's interesting. You raise that. I was going to start off by saying that the whole horrific experience of the Holocaust seems to dictate the politics of many Jewish Americans, as does slavery influence the politics of African Americans, and the slaughter of Native Americans influence them, and so on and so on.
Yes.
And part of the question is, at which point did you separate the political from the religious teachings, the fundamental doctrines of the synagogue, of the Talmud? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I have to say that Israel and its policies have almost nothing to do with religious teachings. Remember that Israel was set up as a secular state originally, and its conflict with Palestinians did not emerge out of a religious tradition. It emerged from a nationalist enterprise in Palestine on the part of Jews that flowed from the oppression that we were facing in the rest of the world, and we jumped from the burning buildings of Europe and landed on the backs of Palestinians, and unfortunately we hurt them terribly in that landing. But we didn't jump in order to hurt them, and we certainly didn't jump in order to fulfill religious principles. In other words, Jews did not come back to our ancient homeland because they were religious people looking for a way to fulfill their religious ideals. In fact, the Zionist movement had as its central notion that we should build a nation like all other nations, that we could regularize Jewish existence and hence not be in this vulnerable position that we were through so much of our history when in both Europe and in Arab lands we were oppressed. So I don't think that we want to say that this is a spiritual or religious enterprise. Now, it's true that in the past 20 to 30 years, religious parties have gained a lot of power in Israel, and they have intensified some of the craziness in Israel's policies. But that's not the same thing as saying that the fundamental struggle there derived from religion. It didn't. It derived from this terrible situation of Jews desperately jumping from the burning buildings of Europe, landing on the backs of Palestinians, not being able to recognize the pain that we caused the Palestinian people in the course of our jump, because we were jumping from this terrible and outrageous thing that was happening to us, the murder of one out of every three Jews alive in the 20th century. So we jumped, and when they started to say, well, you're hurting us, we said, well, don't tell us about your hurt. Our hurt is worse. And of course it was worse, that we were facing genocide, not simply losing our homes. But that didn't mean that we weren't also causing pain. And our pain was so great that we were unable to acknowledge the pain we were causing somebody else. And this is the tragedy of the situation. This is that it's not like a bunch of evil people against a bunch of good people. It's us as refugees. And the Palestinians, when we were refugees, the Palestinians said, no, you can't come to this land. That was an immoral choice. And that made us very angry at Palestinians. And then when we jumped and landed on their backs, we just couldn't see their pain as being that significant because our pain was so great. So when we look at that situation, we also have to look at the reality of what 1,500 to 2,000 years of Christian oppression did to the Jewish people, and what a good 1,200 years of Islamic oppression did to the Jewish people, that led to a Jewish people that is distorted in some important ways. Because the truth of the matter is, and this I'm sure you know in other oppressed minorities as well, oppression doesn't bring out the best in people. It actually brings out some good things, but some screwed up things also. And we, the Jewish people, have both some wonderful things about us and some very deeply screwed up and hurt things about us.
Well, let me...
Because all of that history has made us feel so fearful that we're not able to recognize in the current situation our real power. Mm-hmm. And we see ourselves so much as victims that we have never been able to recognize in the current situation the way in which we are oppressors also.
Rabbi Michael Lerner is the editor of Tikkun magazine and the co-founder with Cornell West of the Tikkun community. We spoke with him last October. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.